The Nature Stories podcast, where people and place intersect.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.
Simon, that's the male orangutan, right?
Yeah, that's
my guy. Can't believe it.
He's one of our dominant males in the forest. Large cheek pads, large size, good healthy coat, and he's one of our best orangutans in this forest.
Unbelievable. Just sitting there. I'm sitting 10 meters below a male orangutan. Oh, now I see his face. Oh, he's going for a swing. Oh.
I'm Samantha Brown. You're listening to the Nature Stories podcast. This week, we travel to the world's only tropical peat swamp forest in Kalimantan, Borneo. We learn about efforts to preserve the peat bogs as well as the orangutans who live there. This podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Each week, we bring you pieces about the intersection between people and place. Up now, a boat trip through Borneo, produced by Anne Blair Gould with Radio Netherlands.
Hello, recently I visited one of the world's largest islands, Borneo, and I took a boat trip round an enormous area of peat swamp forest called Sabango in Kalimantan. That's the Indonesian part of Borneo to the south. The swamp forest itself is almost totally impenetrable, which is why I had to go by boat around the edges of this massive piece of forest. My first stop was a place called the Natural Laboratory, which is actually deep into the forest. So once I was there, it was out of the boat and into the swamp in hot pursuit of biologist Simon Hussen and the object of his study, wild orangutans. It's 7:40 in the morning. It's very warm, a lot of mosquitoes. And Simon, being very tall, is striding far on ahead. Who's on the other end of your radio, Simon?
That's Thomas, who's following the orangutan at the moment.
Okay, he's giving us orangutan bearings.
Yeah.
Simon, what's likely to be in this water here? Or should I not be asking you this?
Well, no, there's fish, there's frogs, but it's because it's so acidic, pH of only 3, we actually drink it.
Oh, is that not too acidic? It sounds so...
It means that there's nothing living in it. There's no amoebas, nothing that make you sick.
Oh, right. Well, that's good. It's brown. It's sort of orangutan-coloured, actually. It's sort of orangey-brown.
It's actually described as tea-coloured, because it basically is tea. It's just full of bits of leaves and other plants.
So tell me about this peat. I mean, I keep hearing, because we are not just in a tropical forest, we're in a tropical peat bog. What's so special about that? What does that mean?
Well, peat is partially decayed organic material. It means it's leaves that come and they can't decay because it's waterlogged and it's acidic. So it just builds up year on year on year. Where we're standing now, there's just 2 metres of peat going down beneath us, of which the oldest is probably about 1,000 years old.
And one of the most tragic parts of what's happening at the moment is that the peat is drying up because of the canals which are built to ferry out the wood, is that right?
Absolutely, yep. It's drying out, and when peat dries out, it degrades, the trees fall over, and there's even more risk of fire.
Okay. Where are we going now?
We're heading about 300 metres into the forest to see Beethoven.
To see Beethoven? Who's a male orangutan, I take it?
One of our dominant male orangutans.
Wow, hooray. Whoop. Okay, that was knee deep. Simon, I can see there's a tree here with some white pool of milky liquid in it. What sort of tree is that?
This is called a gelatong tree. The white liquid is the sap of the tree, which is a kind of latex, a forest latex, that's commonly used to make chewing gum. Quite a lot of local people in the villages work here collecting the sap. They scar the tree, the sap runs out, and it's really important to the local community.
So what do? They've scarred it with a sort of diagonal spiral scar on the outside here, and then they tap?
Exactly. They scar it, they form little rivulets that the latex can run down, and at the bottom of these scars they hang a bag on a couple of sticks stuck into the trunk. They hang a bag, and when the scar at the latex runs out very quickly, collecting the bags. They get all the bags together. It's quite hard work, and they form into big blocks and sell it in the market.
And how do they get it out? Because it's quite dense forest here.
A lot of it is backbreaking work. It forms into big blocks, but they also use the canals. Before, they would use the logging railway and the loggers would help them get out. Now they use the canals. It's a tricky problem. We want to close the canals, but these people need the canals for their livelihood. So we need to work together with them to build the dams and help them get a better price for their product.
Simon, that's the male orangutan, right?
Yeah, that's
the male orangutan. Can I believe
it? He's one of our dominant males in the forest. Large cheek pads, large size, good healthy coat, and he's one of our best orangutans in this forest.
Fantastic. He's sitting right up high in a tree about, 10 metres high, something?
Yeah, that's right. He's eaten the fruit of the gelatin tree, the tree that produces the latex. And he could sit there for hours if he likes it.
Oh, fantastic. I hope he does. This is so exciting. Just sitting there. I'm sitting 10 metres below a male orangutan. Oh, now I see his face. Oh, he's going for a swing. Ah, cheek pads. Huge cheek pads. He's just shifting position. Not going far.
He's just getting some fruit from the outer branches at the moment. And a male orangutan can eat all the fruit in a tree in about an hour or so if he's really hungry.
Just sitting in the tree, swaying gently as he just shifted position, just calmly eating fruit. Fantastic, a wild orangutan, yeah.
In the whole Sabanga forest, we think there's about 7,000 orangutans. That's over an area of about 5,500 square kilometres, 550,000 hectares. I mean, it is the largest single area of lowland rainforest left in Borneo.
Yeah.
It's a massive swamp, you know, you fly in from Jakarta, it's nothing but jungle all the way. For the orangutans, it's the largest population of orangutans in the world.
Still, I mean, 6,000-7,000 sounds like a lot, but of course, you know, it should be more really, shouldn't it?
It's a lot, but you go back 10 years, we had double that number. It's the same story right across Borneo. We've got 50,000 to 60,000 animals, but you go back 10 years, it was over 100,000. The numbers are dropping quickly. The illegal logging, the fires, particularly the oil palm, and there's still a hunting problem going on.
Good news is, of course, this whole area was declared a national park October 2004, right? But, well, caught. Another bit came raining down on their head. No, this area is now a national park, but, I mean, it's one thing declaring a national park, it's another thing protecting it and making sure it stays pristine.
Absolutely. The term that is often used around the world is paper park. The government draws a line on a map and then leaves it to its own devices, and it's not respected and it's not protected. So it's been an incredible job and a very difficult job getting to this stage, getting this area declared a national park. But in many ways, the real work starts here. We have to get the local community involved and working together with the national park. We have to help them.
He's
on the move. We have to help them improve their livelihoods, and we have to stop the illegal logging problem, close the canals, and ensure this place has a future.
He's always moving from tree to tree now. Ooh. Massive great animal. How heavy would he be?
He would be somewhere in the region of 90 to 100 kilos.
Wow. And very long arms, huh?
Very long arms, 2 metre arm span.
And he knows we're there. I'm sure he does. Not for nothing, all this breakfast raining down.
Oh, yeah.
He's not worried. He's probably used to you.
He knows we're there. He's used to us. We've spent many, many days following him.
I think he'd be happy to know he's called Beethoven there.
He's one of the first. We started numbering from A, so he's number two, and we got to Beethoven.
So who have you got so far?
Oh, we've got Aristotle and Beethoven. We've got Cleopatra. She's one of the key females.
Oh, he's coming down lower. Fantastic. Oh, my God. Oh, he really is. He just jumped onto a very thin, spindly tree, which sagged under the enormous weight, and now he's coming further down. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm.
That was fantastic.
I hope you got that.
I did. And right on cue, no editing or anything.
That sounds called the long call. That's his way of telling all the other males that he's here, he's around, get out of his way.
And you could hear that for quite some kilometres around, couldn't you?
You can hear that for one or two Ks, yeah. And all the other males know he's there. It's their way of saying, yeah, I'm here, I'm the boss. And if the other male disagrees with that, that's when they'll fight.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been sitting there so peaceably and now suddenly all this movement and all this noise. It's fantastic. Yes.
Well, after that fantastic experience, there was nothing for it but to trek all the way back to Simon's base camp, and there I met his wife, Helen Morrow Bernard, who's studying the ecology and behaviour of Sabango's orangutans.
Well, orangutans have been known to be semi-solitary or solitary, particularly the males. A male will mature, get his cheek pads, which are big flanges around the male's face. They sort of look like
Wings on the side of their cheese. And they've got bone in their gather as well. I never realised that.
Yeah, they can be used for resonating sound. There's still a lot of research going on to reasons why they have this and what the long call is used for, because the males have this sort of plate on their face which will resonate the sound when they make their long calls. And the long calls are used for telling other orangutans, I'm here, so that they can space themselves out. Also to notify the females that they're around. If there's a female in estrus, if she wants to meet up with the male.
What sort of age do orangutans live to, as far as we know?
There's never been research done in the wild long enough, but in zoos, orangutans have lived till 50s, 60s in zoos, so they think that in the wild they probably live to the same ages, probably into their 60s. The longest research has been done in orangutans at Tanjung Puting by Baruta Gildicus, and that's been 30 years.
Yeah.
And that's still not the lifespan of an orangutan.
Yeah, because they mature 20 years or something like that?
The females can, when they get to the age of 15, can start having offspring, and they probably won't start actually having offspring until they're a bit older than that. And then there's an 8-year interbirth rate between offspring.
So 8 years? Wow.
Yeah, it's a very long interbirth rate, which means that the overall number of infants that one female can have maybe only be 4 or 5.
Yes. Gosh, that's not good conservation when we think about sort of wanting them to reproduce and produce more.
Yep, for conservation, it's not a good sign that they have such a long interbirth rate, particularly when a lot of the females are the ones that hunters look for to get at the babies.
Yeah.
So it's the females that are the group that are suffering a lot from hunting.
Yeah. What can you tell me about the sort of cycle of peat and orangutans? Because, as you said earlier, we didn't know that orangutans lived in peat forests, but they do.
Yeah, this is a very important forest. Orangutans, they adapt to whichever habitat they're living in. The way that they live in this forest is different to the way they'll live in dry forests, where the trees are a lot taller. The way that they make their nests is different here. They make much lower nests, and they use a lot of trees, which they tie in together to make their nests, when other forests might just use one tree. They're very important for seed dispersal, not just in peat swamp forests, but in a lot of other forests as well. So they're very important for the whole ecosystem.
And, of course, the threat to the peat is these canals that have been dug to ship, if you like, the logs out.
Yeah, the canals are the big problem, because the way peat accumulates is having a lot of water, which is very acidic. The organic material can't decompose because the water is so acidic, and that's how peat forms. With the drainage, it's taking all the water out of the area, and decomposition of the peat is starting to occur. Mm-hmm. So the peat is starting to degrade and starting to drop. This in turn takes away the support of the trees, the root systems start rotting, which they haven't got the defenses to protect themselves, because usually they've got water there. So one of the big problems is having the tree falls from the degradation of the peat. The drying of the peat, in turn, it's very vulnerable to fire, and once fire starts in the peatland, it's very, very difficult to put out. So that is the big problem, is the canals. And to solve that, we really need to dam the canals.
So that people are aware, I mean, we're just struggling through the jungle just now. We saw a canal. I mean, they're not wide things that ships can sail down or anything, and then we're talking about little channels that may be a couple of feet wide or something like that, is that right? And yeah, maybe a couple of feet deep?
They're usually about a metre deep or metre and a half deep, and usually about a metre or 2 metres wide. They are small in comparison to when you think of the great big canals that you have in Holland, but there's hundreds of them. And in a peatland, it's unnatural to have that. The peat, the water should be staying in the peatland. It's like a sponge, but as soon as you dry out a sponge, it loses its capacity to hold water. Mm. And that's what's happening with all these canals. With hundreds of them all around the Sabanga, draining all the water out of the peatland, it's having an effect, and it's been 8 years now with all this drainage.
How are you damming them? How are you able to dam them?
Well, at the moment, there is no damming going on because people own these canals and you have to get permission from the people that own them.
The local people?
Yeah, local people, the loggers, people who are collecting gelatin still want to use these canals to gain access into the forest. It's very, very difficult. So you have to get the permission of the owner and of the people who are using the canals. And at the moment, we've just done temporary dams in our grid system, which we've used tarpaulins. And it's very simple. You just put a few sticks in and some tarpaul, and that works as a temporary measure, and it really needs permanent dams put in there.
So what can we do about it? Can we somehow persuade the owners? Can we give them an alternative? Can we pay them? How can we persuade them that this is important stuff?
Well, now that the area has been made into a national park, hopefully the status that it is a national park, hopefully the forestry department can say to these people, well, actually, you don't own them anymore because now it is a national park. But even if you say that, you still need the people to respect this and not break the dams when they are made. And you need the gelatin people who are using it to respect this as well. They will want access, so you have to come up with some other way or form of access for them so that they can enter the forest but without breaking the dams. And that's the difficult bit, is gaining the support from the local people.
Well, back on the motorboat, I headed for our next stop, Paduran Village, where people are being encouraged to grow crops like the medicinal plant aloe vera instead of going into the forest to cut trees.
Well, as you can probably hear in the background, it's well and truly the rainy season here in Borneo, in Kalimantan. I'm now sitting with, will you introduce yourself, a very tall man who works for WWF. Who are you?
Hello, I'm Klaas Jan Teulen and I'm the conservation director for WWF Indonesia.
So, we've stopped off at a village which is actually inhabited by trans-migrants. There's the people that moved from Java.
Yeah, that's right. It's about 20 years ago, under the, at that time, very popular trans-migration program from the Indonesian government. People from Java have been sent out throughout the archipelago, and they started building a village here 20 years ago, and in a period of 10 years they now are 4 settlements. The people here are relatively poor, there is very little economic activity, the land is very poor, the access to markets is very limited, there are no roads, people have to be transported by boats, which in the wet season is possible, but in the dry season becomes pretty difficult because of the low level of water in the area. So what WWF is trying to do to reduce the dependence of these communities on the forest areas, we try to not only directly help the communities in setting up alternative livelihood programs, helping them with looking at agricultural products which can be grown in this area and also can be marketed, which would give income. We also facilitate the cooperation with the government because we feel that the government has to invest in developing those communities and make those communities not too dependent on the natural resource, which basically in this area are the logs. So to get people out of the forest and get them out of the logging activities, we would like to bring into this village livelihood programs which make sense, which have an opportunity, and which allow the villages themselves to develop and gain income from.
Like this aloe vera place, yeah. Here at the moment. So tell me who you are. You're Sandy, right?
Yeah, I'm working for Sabangau Project. I am a socio-economic development module leader for WWF.
Wow, that's a long title.
Yeah.
So you're running this project that teaches people how to grow aloe vera.
Yeah. Because after 1 year we work in here, we saw that a lot of people in here, mostly young people, they're working for illegal logging. So we try to introduce them and invite them go back again to focus on agriculture, more for sustainable agriculture. And we introduce them to pilot plantation on aloe vera. Why aloe vera? Because there is still big market in Java, and also for the cultivation we need not really high technology.
Oh,
this
yes.
is aloe vera.
Well, we're holding a big leaf, but it's almost three-dimensional. It's about half a meter long, and it's got sort of ridges up either side. It's like slightly spiny, green, and very, very sort of fat is all I can say. A bit like a cactus, but then without the spines. So it's enormous. And then the stuff that you need is inside that.
Yeah. We call it jelly.
Jelly,
yeah.
Yes.
We make kind of a sticky rice and mix with this jelly.
Yes.
And it's really good for the health. It's
yes.
good for... There is many functions, like if you had a blood pressure, something like that, or heart attack.
Yes.
Or local Viagra.
Yes. So it's very popular,
yeah.
I can see.
Uh-huh. And you can sell it to cosmetic producer in Jakarta. And what WWF doing is we already try to initiate marketing for local people in here, mostly for local market and then also market in Jakarta.
Yes, fantastic. And what other things can you do with it? Can you eat it?
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, how do you eat it?
Like
yes.
a candy, something
yes.
like that?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, nice.
Well, leaving Patiran village behind, the next stop was Foundation Boss, which is the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation. It was founded in the early 90s by Dutchman Willie Smits as a rescue and rehabilitation centre for young orangutans, and I have to say, I was quite overwhelmed by what I saw. Communications officer Joe Lan van Leeuwen showed me round. Now we're standing, it's sort of mid to late afternoon, the sun is going down, and we have a sight in front of us, which is at the same time absolutely, it makes me want to cry with both joy and with sadness, because what we see is about 25, 30 little orangutans, and they're playing, and each has their own human mother. And yet it means, of course, that for every orangutan here, it means the mother has been killed. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All the little ones you see here are all little orphans, and they're all victims from illegal logging, the killing of their mothers, to sell the little babies on the illegal markets, to sell them as a pet, and also the logging for the palm oil plantations, just disappearing of their habitat.
We have, I think, about 25, something like that, orangutans of very young age.
35, 40 orangutans over here at the moment. And these little orangutans are somewhere in between 1.5 to 3 years old.
It's like watching a lot of people with their children in a way, because little orange fluffy children with very long arms. Because yeah. there's a sort of playground here with lots of tires and things for them to swing
and
swings,
on. Yeah.
And they're all playing together, and they're playing with a wheelbarrow there. It's just, as I say, I mean, it's breathtaking.
Yeah, they are like little children. Orangutan babies, they are being taken care of by their mother for 7-8 years before they start to live independent in the forest, before they start their life on their own. So that is what we try to do here as well, to give them a surrogate mother to take care of them, to teach them as many skills as possible to survive in the forest. For the moment, we release them into the wild.
This is what makes it extra sad in a way, because as you say, orangutans actually do stay with their mothers for an awfully long time. And so when the mother is shot, I mean, that's, you know, they would be helpless if they didn't have anybody to look after them.
Yeah. If there weren't any rehabilitation centers like this, then the little orangutan would die as well.
Yeah. So we saw them coming at about, you know, well, it's now about 4 o'clock, about 3:30. They came out of the forest. Does that mean they've been in the forest all day?
Yeah, they play in the forest for the whole day. Around 7 o'clock in the morning, the groups leave to the forest. And then the orangutans are playing in the forest for the whole day. The babysitters, they teach them some skills, how to climb trees when they are very little. They motivate them to go high up in the trees, that they have to find the fruit high up in the trees.
What about the ladies themselves? How do you find these ladies? I mean, this is as you say, a 24-hour day operation. I mean, these women, they must be so dedicated.
The babysitters here, they all come from the local villages around Njaro Menteng, because that is one of our aims, to work as very closely together with the local people, to provide them alternatives, to create awareness among the local people also in many different ways. And the best thing to do, I think, is to involve them in what we're trying to establish here.
And then what happens? Because orangutans, as far as we know, we think possibly live 50 years or so. So what happens to these monkeys when they get bigger?
In the rehabilitation process, they go to the next step. We call that the midway house. They also play the whole day in the forest, but the difference with here is if they have the skills to make their own nests and if they like to stay in the forest during the night, then we try to motivate that as well. Then they go to the islands. That's a kind of examine for the orangutans, and if we see that they have enough skills to survive in the forest on their own and they have a strong personality to survive, then we release them in the wild. Hopefully they make it.
And how many orangutans pass their exams? Is that such a funny question?
Yeah, well, that's a bit difficult to say at the moment because Nyaro Menteng exists now for 5 years and we are still working very hard to open up our first release site for the orangutans who are under care of the Nyaro Menteng rehabilitation program. And we really hope to release the first orangutans as soon as possible, and that's about 40 orangutans at the moment.
I was just going to say, there was one just escaping coming towards us because they're frightfully curious, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they're very curious. Yeah.
Well, all being well, we'll get a chance to see this island that they get released on and see how they do with their exams. So we took yet another boat trip to the test islands where rehabilitated orangutans are released and kept under careful observation. We just come to the place on the island where the orangutans get fed, and it's a bonanza because masses of bananas and aubergines have been brought to this one place, and the whole tree is full of orangutans, small, medium-sized and large. That's one just hanging there. He's got a whole hand of bananas in his mouth. He must have about 8 bananas. Oh, and how many? I can see at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 orangutans all in one tree.
Yeah, we are in a big river behind the orangutan rehabilitation center, the Rongan River. And this is one of the 3 islands the Bos Foundation can use to pre-release orangutans. And the islands actually are the last stage because we have the intention to release all the orangutans back into the wild. And this is a kind of last graduation before we can bring them back to the wild.
It's really an exam to see if they can fend for themselves. I noticed just now that you there's a boat next to us, you can probably hear it in the background, full of bananas. So bananas are being brought to the island. They don't have to learn to feed for themselves?
Yeah, many different kind of fruits we bring twice a day to the islands. That is to feed them a little bit extra. We have many fruit trees on the island where they can find their own fruit. But because this island is not big enough to carry 44 almost adult orangutans, so we have to feed them a little bit extra.
So how do you know when an orangutan is qualified? I mean, there are 44 here. It's dense jungle on this island. How do you know when an orangutan has passed the test?
We do observations every day. The technicians are here, and when they come to the feeding places, we watch them closely, how they behave, their body weight and everything. And yeah, that is how we test their skills to see if they are ready for release.
And is it possible to say sort of what sort of percentage of orangutans make it?
No, we are still preparing a release site south of the Maawas area, also from the Bos Foundation, also in central Kalimantan. So yeah, it's for us very difficult to say, very difficult to talk in percentages at this moment. Yeah,
I understand. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying you're preparing an area. What sort of area would that be?
Yeah, that is still primary rainforest, definitely. And we want to protect that area also. And also from there, we keep a close eye on all the orangutans to see how they do. Yeah. Because it's the first time that we want to release orangutans from the Nyaro Menteng Rehabilitation Center.
Yes.
And also maybe to talk in percentages in the future to see how successful we are.
Yeah. This is a fantastic sight that we have in front of us. I mean, it's an orangutan tree, isn't it?
Yeah, it's full of orangutans at the moment. And yeah. Actually, who is looking at who at the moment? Because they are looking at us as well as we are looking to them. Yeah.
And it really strikes me once again that these are really dark orangutans, aren't they? Dark-coloured
orangutans. Yeah, that's one of the differences between the Borneo orangutan and the Sumatra orangutan. The Sumatra orangutan is more orange, and the Borneo orangutan is more dark brown hair, reddish. Yeah.
Well, looking at them here, you know, all swinging about in the trees. I mean, they're fairly young, some of these, aren't they? I mean, apart from the babies. I mean, that one there, for instance, how old would he or she be?
Oh, she's about 5, 6 years old, maybe 7, yeah.
Oh, she's made herself a sort of nest there, hasn't she?
Ah! Yeah, It's what they do. They make nests for themselves when they're younger, also to play in or to have a little nap.
Yeah.
But for the night, they are also making nests for themselves to sleep in.
What I was going to say, they look to be having fun here. You know, they're standing at the place where all the bananas and all the rest of the fruit is delivered and vegetables. And they obviously seem to be enjoying each other's company. But once they're released, of course, they're probably a bit on their own, really, aren't they? Because naturally, they're solitary.
Naturally, they're solitary living animals. And luckily they can practice here in a group. But yeah, once they are released, they have to find their own way and they will meet up somewhere in the forest if there are big fruiting trees. And so they socialize a little bit, but normally they're solitary living animals. Yeah.
Well, I wish you a lot of success out there in the big it's a jungle out there.
This podcast is produced with support from the Nature Conservancy, committed to saving the last great places on Earth. Our music is by 35th Parallel. To hear more stories like these, go to the Public Radio Exchange, prx.org. Send us your thoughts and feedback to podcast@tnc.org. From Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Samantha Brown. I'll be back next week with a new Nature Stories podcast.